Welcome to the Cuban Family Roots Podcast, a monthly podcast dedicated to discussing Cuban history and ancestral roots. I'm your host, Aileen Vega, podcasting from Woodbridge, New Jersey. As a genealogy enthusiast, I created the Cuban Family Roots Podcast to help others in their genealogical journey. I conduct interviews with Cuban researchers and geneticists, authors, and those with knowledge and expertise in Cuban history and genealogical research. I'm committed to conducting interviews that will point to genealogical information and resources to lead family historians in the right path to finding their family roots. From 1492, when Columbus claimed the island for Spaniards, to present-day Cuban, our history has been rich and traumatic. Now our family history is slowly vanishing due to archival despair. Cubans inside and outside the island yearn to capture, learn our past, our origins, and our ancestral roots. Knowledge of our history is the key to keeping our Cuban family roots alive. I hope you enjoy listening to each episode as much as I enjoy producing them. The Cuban Family Roots Podcast can be heard on Spotify, Radio Public, Google Podcasts, and many other platforms. You can support us by simply listening and engaging. Welcome to another episode of the Cuban Family Roots Podcast. I'm your host, Aileen Vega, podcasting from Woodbridge, New Jersey. In this episode, I interview Gerardo Gonzalez, who recounts his childhood in Placetas. He discusses how it was to return to Cuba, to the Cuba he left as a young boy to reconnect with his roots. He recounts moments in his life while in Cuba and his love for his grandfather, who he never was able to see again. He dedicates his memoir to all the refugees who have an opportunity to come to America. As a dean at Indiana University, he was fortunate to initiate a scholarship fund to help others came looking for a better life in this country. Everything he was able to accomplish was because he had his grandfather and family who were his anchors throughout his life. Proceeds from his memoir are donated to refugees, Cuban or non-Cuban alike. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoy the interview, and my apologies to all my listeners as I was not able to do any recordings January and the beginning of February. While a recording was done with my cousin Christian, that recording had some issues and we have to do the recording again. It was a fascinating episode about dichos cubano, Cuban sayings. But I leave you now with Gerardo Gonzalez as he recounts his childhood in Placetas. Stay tuned. It is a pleasure to have you. Thank you for allowing us this opportunity to interview you. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. And let me thank you for inviting me to be a part of the Cuban Family Roots Podcast. I'm very excited about this opportunity.
Likewise, you wrote a memoir, A Cuban Refugee's Journey to the American Dream, The Power of Education. And I wanted to ask you, what motivated you and what did you feel it was necessary?
Well, Aileen, my motivation for writing the book was going back to Cuba for the first time almost 50 years to the date. After my family and I came to the United States as Cuban refugees and seeking exile. And I grew up here in the United States. I heard lots of stories at home, have very vivid memories of life in Cuba because I was 11 years old when we left. Over the years, stayed in touch with friends and family who were left behind, some who came to the United States. But I never had given it a lot of thought to going back myself. It was something that was in the back of my mind. I was hoping that one day I have the opportunity to go back and see it. But I was busy here, raising my own family, going to college, working. And so it wasn't something that was front and center to my life. And when I went to Indiana University, which is where I worked for the last 20 years of my career, in 1212, when things were beginning to open up between the United States and Cuba, I was invited to lead a group of Indiana University alums to Cuba as part of a people-to-people cultural exchange tour. And I jumped at the opportunity. I was excited to go, although somewhat apprehensive because I knew the sacrifices that my parents had made to make it possible for my sister and I to come to this country, and actually had conversations with them before I went to make sure they were comfortable with the idea of me going and so forth. But once I went, all of a sudden, even before the plane landed, as it was approaching the runway at the Havana airport, I started getting all these feelings and memories that were just flowing back. And they were emotions that I didn't realize I had. And even seeing the palm trees align the driveway created a feeling of being overwhelmed, just being there, seeing a simple sight like that, which, you know, anyone who has grown up in Cuba knows how ubiquitous the palm trees are. They're everywhere, especially in the countryside. Mm-hmm. And so it was lots of feelings and emotions that then led to more conversation with my parents about what it was like for them, what motivated them to want to leave everything that they had, their own families, so that we could come to the United States. And of course, the answer consistently, or the answer that ran throughout those conversations, we did it for you, for the children. And that made me want to then begin to put into writing my own feelings and the many conversations that I have with both my father and my mother, who were still both living at the time I started to write the book, and even to the point that where I finished the draft of the book. And so those conversations are also intertwined into the book, but it's really a family story. It's the story of Cuban refugees looking for a better life in the United States and sacrifices that the parents made to give their children opportunities that we would not have had in Cuba.
Mm-hmm. That brings me to my next question. You were born and you lived in part of your childhood in Placetas. Can you walk us through a day in the life of young Gerardo Gonzalez, day-to-day in Placetas? And what was that like?
Sure. My life as a child, as I just mentioned, you know, we left in 1962. I was 11 years old at the time, so I remember a lot of things from my childhood. Placetas is a small town in what was then called the province of Las Villas, is now Villa Clara, in the central part of the country. It was a kind of a traditional, typical small town Cuban city. People had lots of community interactions, family oriented, hardworking people. It was in the midst of the sugarcane industry. There were several centrales, sugar mills in the area. Many people were employed in those sugar mills. And my life was that of a typical young Cuban child. I remember playing pickup ball in the street. Placetas is known for having some of the wider streets in all of Cuba. Mm-hmm. And so it was very easy to organize the game with other kids in the neighborhood. We used to make the balls ourselves from different artifacts that we had around the house. Just pick up a stick, put a couple of mats at the corners of each side of the street, and then we had a field, and we would play those, games like that. Lots of family visits, families in Cuba, and particularly in Placetas, were very close-knit. My grandparents, my grandfather, my grandmother, and an aunt, my mother, my grandmother's sister, I guess a great aunt, lived right around the corner for us. I remember spending a lot of time at their house, playing with what was then my best friend who lived right next to my grandmother. His name is Hugo. Climbing trees in the backyard, my grandmother to pick up traditional, you know, tropical fruits. We had a tree of nispero that we used to climb and you know, just knock those down to enjoy. We take trips to the countryside. My mother was the youngest of a family of seven children. They all live in the area. Some of them work for the sugar mills, and we would take trips to the campos, you know, to the countryside to visit them on weekends. And my cousins and I would run in the sugar fields and, you know, watch las carretas full of sugar canes going to the mills. My father liked to hunt from time to time. He had a small caliber rifle, I think what we think of as a 22, and he would sometimes take me out to the country to shoot quail, or, you know, just have fun. Day to day, I went to school. I went to a Catholic school. I remember coming home every day for lunch. You know, the tradition in Cuba and in Placetas for sure was to take long lunch breaks. So, you know, you have morning session at school, and then you went to home. We had a big lunch, relax, sometimes take a siesta, and then go back to school. It was a very typical young Cuban childhood until the revolution came. And after 1959, when Castro took over, the ambience began to change. One of my father's favorite thing to do was to go to the Central Park. You know, all Cuban towns have a small, not all, I suppose, but most of them have a small, or some not so small, Central Park. And in Placetas, that park was called Parque de los Laureles, small Central Park. It was a lot of fun going there. My father would take me there, and the adults would play domino. The kids would buy guarapo or some other traditional drink and would run around the park, or go to the La Glorieta and listen to the music. It was just kind of fun. But after the revolution, things began to change. And instead of music emanating from the speakers in the Central Park, what we consistently heard were revolutionary slogans. And the neighborhood became too suspicious of one another. The committees for the defense of the revolution were created, and their job was to watch what people were doing in the block. And so I began to be bullied, because pretty soon word got out that our family was planning to leave the country, and anyone who was not supporting the revolution was labeled as, you know, counter-revolutionary and suspect. And so other kids in the neighborhood would hear that, and then I was singled out in the street for bullying and whatnot, especially since I was attending a Catholic school, which also were not particularly welcome. One of the first things Fidel did was get rid of private schools, and Catholic schools were one of the primary targets. I was overweight at that point, and that was another source of bullying in the context of people who were no longer welcome in the neighborhood. So by the time that my parents decided to leave, I was kind of looking forward, because I saw it as an opportunity to get some relief from what had become, you know, very uncomfortable kind of existence. But up to that point, it was a very typical young child doing the things that young children in Cuba do and enjoy family celebrations. My grandparents always celebrated my grandfather's birthday on New Year's Day, and we always welcome that opportunity to participate in those kinds of celebrations. So it was a real adjustment, leaving eventually and coming to the United States.
Next question. You worked at university and your book. You have a world-renowned library and archive system. What from you for their archive? And how did that project come about? And in addition to that, can you also tell us about the scholarship project?
Yes. Once I came to the United States, our family came to the United States, I began to pursue a college education. I'm the first in my family to attend college. My father was an auto mechanic, and my mother in the Cuban tradition was a homemaker, a stay-at-home mom. And when we came to the U.S., my father's greatest concern was finding work to support the family. And, you know, he borrowed some money to buy some tools, started working on friends' cars and their driveways and so forth to get started. And my father always reminded me that if the sacrifices that they had made for their children and for me would be worth it, that I had to get an education, that my younger sister and I had to get an education. And his way of motivating me to get an education was to show me his mechanic hands. He put his hands in front of my face, and he would say, "Mira, Jera, mira mis manos. Quiero que estudies para que cuando tú tengas mi edad, tus manos no estén como las mías. Look, Jera, look at my hands. I want you to get an education so that when you're my age, your hands don't look like mine," he would say to me. And that was my motivation for college, because even though he was saying to me, if you are going to have a better future, you have to get an education. But he didn't know anything about, GPAs or SATs or college planning. And so that was his way of motivating me to get an education. Well, by chance, because I was not really well prepared for a college education, but by chance, I ended up in college. Started at Miami-Dade Community College. We had an open door policy that they went on to get degrees from the University of Florida in Gainesville. I got my bachelor's in psychology, a master's in counseling, and specialist in counselor education, and ultimately a PhD in higher education administration. And so my career in the U.S. became one of an academic. And in 2000, Indiana University recruited me to go to Bloomington, Indiana, to be dean of the School of Education at Indiana University, which is one of the premier research universities in the world. I went there had a long and enjoyable career. I served in the deanship for 15 years, and then I stayed on the faculty for another 5 years before retiring. Well, during the time that I was there, Indiana University was celebrating its 200th year as one of the nation's oldest universities. And they published a series called the Wells Series of books that feature people who have come to Indiana and have had impact. And so the Indiana University Press, which is the academic press that publishes books from Indiana scholars and others, invited me to submit a proposal to write a memoir that would, not only convey my experiences as a first-generation college student, Cuban refugee, but also the difference that education had made in my life. And so that's then led to a conversation. Once the book was published, the book was released in 2018, and had actually become one of Amazon's bestsellers in Hispanic and Latino biographies. But the goal was for me to tell a story. I finished the book, I had collected a number of artifacts that became part of the story. And I thought that the right thing to do at that point was to donate those artifacts to Indiana University, which has a world-renowned, as you said, archive, library and archive system. And they created the Gerardo M. Gonzalez Cuban Refugee Archive or collection. And the artifacts that I gave them include the original telegram that we received in Cuba, giving us permission to leave. You know, you may know that in those days, in order to leave Cuba, you had to get an exit permit, and you had to apply. You had to apply to the government, and they took inventory, and then, you know, everything that you have became the property of the government, and you could still live in your house and work and so forth, but you couldn't sell anything or do anything with that. You just had to wait for the telegram to arrive, giving you permission to leave. And I remember vividly the day that the telegram arrived. I just I rode my bicycle from my father's taller in Cuba at home, and my mother was excitedly in front of the house, waving the telegram in her hand, saying, Hera, apúrate, el telegrama llegó, you know, hurry. The telegram just arrived. And, you know, that was one of those childhood memories that I have of the turmoil that ensued from those telegrams. Well, years later, when I was having conversations with my father about, you know, their experiences and so forth, I asked him about the telegram. And he said, well, the telegram was the last thing. I said, well, último, you know, we went through lots of things to get here. He said, by the way, I still have the telegrams here. He goes to the back of the house in a little briefcase that he had in one of the closets, opened up the briefcase, and in it were not only the original telegram, but my original passport, letters that I had written to my grandfather after we came, and letters that he wrote back to us. And those artifacts and those times around those experiences became part of the memoir and the story that I'm telling. And so when the time came to think about what to do with those artifacts, I decided that I would give them to Indiana University, since they have published my book and they have a way to digitize those items and preserve them in perpetuity. And so it has, you know, like I said, the telegram, original passport, you know, a letter that was especially moving from my grandfather when I was getting my first college degree at Miami-Dade. I wrote to him to let him know I would be getting a degree, and he wrote back a beautiful letter, even though he was not educated himself, a very articulate, lovely letter, thanking how grateful he was and asking me to give thanks to God for, you know, the opportunities that I was having and so forth. So that letter, I also detail or reference in the memoir, and then that letter, you know, I gave to the archives. And then there were other things. There were some medals that Catholic Charities had given us when we relocated, which we had to do from Miami to first Pittsburgh and then New Jersey. Catholic Charities was supporting us to adjust to the new communities, get there, find work, and so forth. And they had given us these buttons that you put in your lapels, to let those people who were welcoming you to the new community say you were the person they were looking for and was being sponsored by Catholic Charities. So I learned very early that for refugees, for immigrants, a little helping hand can go a long way. And so not only did I write my memoir with an eye towards my experiences as a Cuban refugee, learning the language, you know, struggles in American schools, getting an education, how I got there, but also how important it is for this country to continue to receive people from other parts of the world who are seeking freedom and opportunity and can be supported here to get it started. Because we as refugees and immigrants have a lot to give back. And so when I became an academic and eventually dean of the School of Education, Indiana University, my wife and I also created a scholarship from our own funds to support students who have financial need, but also preference given to or special attention given to those who are first generation refugees or immigrants from underrepresented groups. And so that scholarships now fund students who want to go into education to be able to support themselves to achieve that education.
Wow, that's great. That's unbelievable. In your book, you mentioned that one of the most vivid childhood memory is your grandfather's birthday celebrations, which he always held on New Year's Day. Obviously, you were very close to him. How did it impact you not being able to see him again after immigrating to the United States?
Oh, my goodness. I already mentioned a little bit about how important those New Year's birthday celebrations were to our family and to me personally, how vivid those memories are. But my father, my grandfather to me was a figure larger than life. You know, he was had white hair, actually blue eyes. He had a bodega, you know, a small mom and pop bodega in Cuba where he would sell, you know, brown sugar, coffee, and a few of the potatoes, some of the staples during the sugarcane season. He worked in one of the sugar mills, Central Fidencia, in the outskirts of Placeta. But when the season was not operating or at night part-time, he would run his bodegas. And it, one of the things that he did every night on the way home, he would ride a bicycle, and the bicycle had a little basket in front of it, and he would put, you know, stuff that he was bringing home or taking somewhere. So he was his mode of transportation. Well, every night on the way home, he would stop by my house where my parents and I and my sister and I lived. And he would sneak a couple of chocolate bars that he had taken from the bodega to bring me. And of course, my mother said, oh, don't give him that. He won't sleep tonight. You know, he doesn't need to be eating all those sweet, blah, blah, blah. But it became sort of a game, an expectation that I had that at a certain time, my grandfather would come by and give me that that piece of chocolate, which, you know, I treasure. He was a very wise man, as I remember. As a child, I feel privileged to have someone that I could run, you know, around the corner and go see, and always seem to be welcoming and supportive, and obviously care deeply for his grand children. And when we left Cuba, and as part of the conversations that I was having with, in this case, with my father about leaving Cuba, I asked him what was the most difficult thing that they had to do in making this possible. And without hesitation, my father said, the most difficult thing was having a conversation with your grandfather and your grandmother and your Aunt Luisa, who, you know, love you as their own, you and your sister as their own. What a difficult thing it had been for him to ultimately make the decision to leave them behind in Cuba so we could have better opportunities here. And he attributes that to the fact that my grandfather in particular said, without hesitation, when he broached the subject, you know, vete, llévate a los muchachos, ellos son jóvenes, nosotros somos viejos, you know, go, take the children, we're old, we'll be okay. And so I have this image as my grandfather's wise man who made decisions on behalf of the family. And then I have these childhood memories that are so tender and so loving and so inspiring. But I miss the fact that later on, as I got older, I did not have the opportunities to learn more from him as a growing adult or as a, you know, a late adolescent when life becomes more challenging and big questions about identity and so forth come. And so I hang on to those childhood memories, but I also feel an emptiness in my heart not to have been able to, and this is selfish on my part, but not to have been able to gain more from his love and the interactions with him as I became better educated and gained greater understanding of the world, because I think I could have learned a great deal from him. Not seeing him was very difficult. My grandmother did not want to leave Cuba while he was alive, but when he died, we died in his 70s, she then petitioned to come to this country. My parents sponsored her. She had to go to Spain and spend a year in Spain before she was able to join the family in Miami. We had returned to Miami from our travels to other parts of the country in efforts to find work, but eventually settled in Miami. And so having her and around and talking with her was always a lot of fun. And we maintained some of those traditions. Every New Year's, the family got together here. And my father always roasted a pig, you know, that in the Cuban tradition, un puerco asado, you know. So those memories all have become family tradition and family lore. Every New Year's, I miss my grandfather, and I wrote about that also in my book. Is that, you know, a New Year's really never goes by without me thinking about those community and grand celebrations that we had in what was then our old life.
I think that's like a lot of Cuban story, you know, when they have to leave family behind, how painful that is. And Obviously for you and your parents, that must have been very painful. How did your parents feel about going back to Cuba for the first time in 2012 after the 50 years of exile?
Yes, you know, that was weighing heavy on my shoulders when Indiana University asked me to lead a group of alumni back to Cuba because the last thing I wanted to do was go to Cuba in some inadvertent way, make my parents feel bad that I was going back. My father had never wanted to go back to Cuba. And during our conversations, I asked why or what would it be like for him. And in fact, one time he said, I had to laugh a little bit, but he said, oh, Hera, you know, if I went back to Placetas, I would love to go to El Elevado. That was an overpass that defines, you know, landmark in Placetas. And start there at the end of the Elevado and walk through the streets of town, around town. And as I walk, point to Ahí vivía fulanito, ahí vivía menganito, you know, those were my friends. Oh, that's where my taller was. Oh, here's the house that we lived in. So-and-so lived there. And then on the other end of the street.
Hopefully for our sake, things will get better. But just like you, I don't foresee that just based on the past experiences with the government and the exchange and all that. But yes. Geraldo, I was going to ask you, if our audience wants to find your book, where can they purchase it?
Well, the book is on Amazon. Again, the title of the book is A Cuban Refugee's Journey to the American Dream, The Power of Education. And you can look it up by the title. A Cuban Refugee's Journey will take you to the page for ordering on Amazon, or you can look it up by author name, Gerardo Gonzalez, and that would also do it. But it can also be purchased directly from Indiana University Press. You can go on their website and do the same thing, search by book title or by author name, and that would also show it. But on Amazon, the book has become one of the bestsellers on Hispanic and Latin biographies. Those rankings change, you know, sometimes from day to day, but it has been ranked at times as high as the top 50 bestsellers in U.S. Cuba history, on Hispanic and Latino biographies, and so forth. So just go to the website, Amazon, and put the book's title, A Cuban Refugee's Journey to the American Dream, and that should take you to the ordering information and background about the book.
By the way, congratulations on that, you know, being a bestseller. You know, it's not easy, so congratulations on that. And finally, can you tell us who you're donating and supporting with the proceeds from the book?
Oh, yes. Well, you know, as I said, I will always be grateful for the assistance that my family and I received when we came to this country as refugees. And so since 2020, I have been donating all the royalties, the author royalties that come to me from sales of the book to refugee relief efforts. I donated part of it to Afghanistani refugees when the situation in Afghanistan came and many refugees from there came here under U.S. sponsorship. And last year I donated to Ukrainian refugee relief efforts because of the war there and the confrontation with Russia. And I will continue to donate to various refugee relief efforts, whether it be refugees from Latin America or anywhere in the world who come here looking for opportunity, for freedom, who are here legally, but in any way possible, even though it's not a lot of money, if I can help people get a start and ultimately pursue their dreams, not only does that make me feel good that I'm doing a little bit, at least, to help those in need, but I also think that in the long term, it's good for this country. Refugees from any part of the world, Cuban refugees, not an exception, who come here have been able to give back to this country in ways that has made it better. And in fact, one of the things that I donated to the archive at Indiana University, and that is part of my book, is a letter that I received from President Ronald Reagan while he was in office, thanking me for the contributions that I have made to my adopted homeland because the things that I've done professionally and educationally. And I think that every refugee who comes here and is given an opportunity is not only grateful, but is also willing to give back. And that's what I want to do by donating the proceeds from my book to help those who come here with those goals in mind.
Gerardo, thank you so much for all the work that you're doing. We really do appreciate it, and keep up the good work. And thank you so much again for allowing us the opportunity to interview and to learn more about you and your family.
You're very welcome, Eileen. It's been a pleasure talking with you. And again, thank you for inviting me to be part of the Cuban Family Roots podcast.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and like to help support the Cuban Family Roots podcast, please share it with others, post it on your social media, or leave a rating and review. To catch all the latest from me, you can follow me on Instagram at Cuban Family Roots or on Twitter at Cuban Family Roots Podcast or Facebook at Cuban Family Roots Podcast. Thanks again, and I'll see you next time.